Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey. Today's cool fact of the day is that your brain activity is as unique as your fingerprint. And new research has come out that suggests your brain activity could be used like a fingerprint. And scientists use functional MRI or fMRI to create connectivity profiles that allowed researchers to identify brain activities of more than 100 people. Now, scientists use individual brain connectivity to give them specific insights about your intelligence or personality. And by the way, at 40 years of Zen, we can teach your brain to have new connections it didn't have before, which is part of what we do with one of the many different forms of neurofeedback we have there. But here they said it has implications for how scanning brains could be used to develop individualized care. But I predict 20 years from now, it's not like you're going to need stickers on your head or electrodes the way we do it now. You're going to be able to pick these signals up from a distance, which means you'll walk in front of your iPhone 20 years from now and it won't have to recognize your face because it recognizes your brain. How cool is that, right? Or scarier than hell, one of the two. You decide.
Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat cold tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500.
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at leelaq.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount.
Today's guest is a high-performance psychologist who works in the trenches in high-stakes environments where there's no luxury for mistakes or hesitation or failure to respond. We're talking with people from every major sport, Olympians, Fortune 100 CEOs, as well as some of the biggest names you've heard of in terms of artists and musicians. He's a revered speaker on human performance, and you've probably seen him in print and TV and things like that. He co-founded Compete to Create with Seahawks head coach Pete Carroll, who built a framework to enhance high-performance cultures by focusing on mindset training for individual people in cultures. I'm talking about none other than Michael Gervais, who has spent many, many years unpacking and decoding how great performers use their minds to pursue just the very boundaries of what we're capable of as humans. And he runs a podcast called Finding Mastery, where he conducts interviews on that. So you can see why I'd want to have him on Bulletproof Radio, because I care a lot about this. The idea is, look, you finally figured out what to eat. You finally figured out how to turn your brain on. You got a lot of energy. What are you going to do with this newfound energy? Well, let's get some good ideas from Michael. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. And I've listened to your podcast for a long time and really have enjoyed your point of view and the guests and what you tease out of them. So thank you.
Well, thank you for listening. I'm always honored when I find that someone's listening to the podcast. And I'm pretty non-denominational about that. I was sitting in an airplane and the stewardess walks up and goes, look what I have. And it was a copy of the Bulletproof Diet. And she's like, I listened to your show. I'm like, whoa, someone listens to my show. Because I mean, I see the numbers and you see the numbers on Finding Mastery. You know how many people, but it's not personalized. So anytime someone says they've heard it, I'm like, hey, that's kind of cool. So I appreciate that you listen. It actually matters to me. And I always appreciate reviews too. Just it makes it real, right?
Very cool.
Do you deal with that on Finding Mastery? You're sort of like, okay, I'm interviewing someone, I'm having a good time, but then you don't really know that people are listening. Like you know cognitively, but you don't have the
conversation. Yeah, I mean, I think the whole idea for conversations that are working to get to the source is that you've got to get past all of the media mind, all of the thoughts of approval, and to really get into that place where you're helping the other person, or in this case, me, myself, is just working to get to the truth, the authentic truth of what we understand, what we don't understand. And so, yes, to do that, we've got to fade away, you know, that there are lots of people listening. And so that, yeah, it's a little bit of a challenge.
Now, you call yourself a curious adventurepreneur. What the heck is that?
Yeah, well, it's not hard to put those three thoughts together, but curious, okay? So the beginner's mind and really wanting to learn and understand and do so at a progressive clip. And then adventurepreneur is a hyphened word where, I really do value the entrepreneur venture and the frontier that is required to do that well. And I've spent my life in the backcountry, working out, and not always just the backcountry, but I've spent my life effort working with people in the backcountry, living in the backcountry, to better understand how do people operate when there's swift and harsh consequences. And so that adventure part of life, I don't see life as a journey. I see it as an adventure. And I think that those three words matter to me. And so that's how I frame it up.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. And you talk about not having the luxury of second guessing and things like that. One of the things that caught my attention is that you worked with, or you worked on the Stratos mission, the guy with Red Bull who jumped out of a hot air balloon from the very edge of space and all that, which was from 128,000 feet, crazy stuff. What did you do as a high-performance psychologist when you're working with Felix? I'm not even going to try and say his last name. It's Baumgartner, but it's probably French, so I probably said it wrong. But.
No, that was it, yeah. All right. I mean, yeah. So, I'm classically trained as a psychologist with a specialization, if you will, in sport and performance. And then there's no such thing really as a subspecialty, but that subspecialty would be consequential or high-stakes environments. And so what do? We meet the person where they are. We understand the framework that they're working from. So understand his framework. And by the way, Dave, this is all, anything I'll talk about is already publicly available.
Of course, yeah. I mean, yeah, as a psychologist, you're bound by certain things you're not allowed to say. You're not allowed to say it. Just tell me. That's cool.
Yeah, no, for sure. They just did a 30 for 30 on the psychology of his jump, which, shared much of what we're talking about here. And so what do? We figure out what is the sturdy, nimble, flexible framework that he wants to create to do this thing that's never been done before. And if you're going to do stuff that no one has ever done, let alone you yourself, that's a thin herd, tip of the arrow type of experience for people where there's not a whole lot of data points to bounce off of. So essentially what happened for him is that he had an intense, anxious response to being in the suit. And we could call it claustrophobia, but it was just an intense, anxious response. So we just use good science, walk through systematic desensitization, walk through flooding protocols to help him extinguish fear, and just backfilled with, any mental skills that would be able to, or not that he would need to be able to employ to be able to do something that was incredibly dangerous.
So what was the number one thing that helped with that claustrophobia response? Like kind of the top thing of that list?
Well, it's not lost on you probably that a systematic desensitizing to a phobic response is the system itself is, I think, the good stuff, right? So yep. We could say that the tactic of breathing or the awareness of self-talk are important skills, which they are, but it's the scientific method that you walk back by scaling up on a piece of paper from 1 to 100, what is the smallest trigger you have thinking about the the response, and then all the way up to 100. Like, what does the full panic experience feel like? And just listing, you know, every 10 or so, you know, increments, what are those triggers? And so that in and of itself is a really strong, concrete, mechanical way to help somebody externalize this internal sensation of fear.
So the hack was really just sort of exposure therapy, for lack of a better word.
Well, yeah, that's what it is. Those are the two types of exposure therapy, you know, flooding or systematic desensitization. And I wouldn't call it a hack. I would call it like, that's a lot of work now. And, you know, like it's an incredible investment that requires incredible vulnerability, incredible courage, and a very disciplined approach to backfilling the mental skills to be able to do the thing that you want to do. And I think that that's such an eloquent marker for so many of us. You know, those are required: vulnerability, courage, and a disciplined, almost relentless approach to develop the skills necessary.
That relentlessness is really important. And I admit I was baiting you by calling it a hack, because I've heard some of your podcasts. You're like, I don't like hacks, and hacks aren't real. And I look at it as like, you find me the fastest path to get to the results that I want, and that's the hack. And if there is a faster way to get the results, that's the new hack, right? Where it's about excellence in choosing techniques that save you time and energy, right? And so I would have also thought, being an untrained psychologist, in other words, not a psychologist. I would say, well, hey, like, would EMDR work for that? Is there a faster path to turn off the inner response? And for people listening, EMDR is eye movement dissociative response. It's a way for certain traumas to allow you to stop responding to them very quickly. But the idea here is, otherwise, like, oh, I'm a bad person because I have claustrophobia or whatever it is. Or I'm weak, or it's a moral failing, or, you know, I'm not good enough, or whatever the voice in your head says, right? But to go from there, like, okay, is exposure therapy going to be the fastest path or something else? But when I'm using the word hack, it's like, hey, it means you have control of it. And that's what hackers do. They take over control. And so sometimes people respond negatively to the word, but I actually wanted to go deep with you on, okay, like, you know, what's the issue with the term hack, given that context?
Yeah, cool. Well, I think the principles are beautiful that you just said. Like, what is the most efficient way to grow, to change? Like, that is what I think about, like, progression, and like really committing and organizing one's life for that aim is rare. It's hard.
Yeah.
And what I found is that, you know, the word hack, to me, now this is just me, and I'm not suggesting that both of us are not looking for the most efficient ways to find change.
Oh yeah.
But the word hack conjures up a shortcut. It conjures up a path that is not willing or wanting to do the hard yards. And so there is no shortcut to self-discovery. There's no shortcut to awareness and mindfulness. There is no shortcut to, you know, that deep, rich ability to authentically express yourself in any environment. A matter of fact, it's the opposite of a hack. You know, the hack is to, in your words, is to have the most efficient way to grow. Got it. But the most efficient way to grow, coupled with the desire and the crave to be in difficult situations. And when you can get those two things to hang together, to coalesce, there's something really powerful that takes place for, you know, the adventure or the path of, let's call it something really heavy, which is wisdom. Yep. And there's just no hack for wisdom. Now, there's effective ways to learn, you know, but anyways, so that's where I sit on that term. And then,
Well, it's interesting you talk about facing uncomfortable situations, and certainly growth is important. And sometimes pain is a part of that. Like, I decided, having weighed 300 pounds, in the past, and, really having had some issues with just being willing to do almost anything except be alone. I'm like, hey, I'll just go fast in a cave with no one around for 10 miles for 4 days. So I'll just deal with hunger and loneliness. You know, okay, not exactly a super comfortable situation, but you know, a meaningful way to, you know, deal with whatever's going on and make sure that you've got a handle on it. However, I could also have gone to a psychologist, you know, Lucy from Peanuts, and paid my nickel, and sat on a couch for 20 years talking about those things, right? And still been on the path, still been feeling the pain, but not gotten the same results. And it's looking for that word that says, all right, how did I do it with less work? And I'm even going to say less pain, because I like to think, and I want to get your idea on this, Michael, if someone came to you tomorrow and said, look, I can snap my fingers and make you fully enlightened with all the wisdom in the world, right? No cost to you. Do you want it? What would you say?
Sure.
Right. But then you avoided all the pain, all the struggle, all the learning, all the wisdom.
But then, right. Now then it is, what do you do with that wisdom?
Yeah, of course. Right.
So if my answer was, you know, yes, but I've got this deep crave, this real ache to express and to authentically help people do the same, then I'm going to do something with it. You know, right. So okay, let me flash back why I said yes so easily, is that Buddha said something really powerful and said, enlightenment can take lifetimes or the next moment. So keep working. So when you say, you know, can you happen at the, I've been working my life for that. So why would I say no? But if somebody hasn't been working their life and they're like, hey, I could give you whatever, a gold medal, enlightenment, call it whatever you want, and you don't have to work for it. Well, that's going to end up like in the drawer somewhere, you know, where it's like not valued at all because you didn't earn it. And so your dilemma is multifaceted, which I appreciate. And there's a texture to it, right? Which is, I don't think, and this is now me putting on like a theoretical approach, not just like Mike's idea, but my understanding, and I can't point to rich data on it, but it's more of a culmination of insights from research, is that people change because of pain. And the removal of pain is actually a problem in friendship. It's a problem in codependency, and it can be a problem in life coaching as well as psychology. So the best trained professionals and the most incredible friends do not take the pain away.
Yeah.
They help you understand where the pain come from. They sit with you in the pain. They share the pain with you and then stand by your side as you're working through it for some sort of insight. And so, you know, like it's textured.
It is textured. The people who take away the pain are quite often codependent, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we do funny things to ourselves to take away our own pain. We'll drink. We'll flip on social media, TV. We'll talk trash about other people.
Listen to podcasts.
Just kidding. I mean, we do things ourselves to avoid pain. Like, it's hard. Like, it's really freaking hard. And there's no shortcut for that. And I think that you would appreciate this insight, is that the best performers, which I mean when I say performer, I'm talking about a thinker and a doer. Mm-hmm. The best thinker and doers in the world manage stress better than anyone else. Yeah. So they are better at stress. They understand how to not just cope with it, but to use it. And stress is, you know, as you know, distress and eustress. Distress is hard. Eustress is wonderful. It's still challenging. And the best performers in the world are able to manage stress better than the rest of us. And so I just say that because that's, for most of us, that's what pain is, stress.
Is that a learned skill, that stress management?
There's a biological component to it. You know, there's some neuropeptide Y that people are born with at different variances. There's some genetic coding that we think could be at play. And as you well respect omnigenetics and genetics, and, you know, it's a wild west right now. So we don't exactly know, but I would put my stake in the ground that there's some genetic coding there. There's some environmental stuff and there's some learned behaviors, right? And so all of that does impact our psychology, right? And our psychology, what's wonderful about psychology is that we can change it. It's like software, like we can change it.
Some of the studies are really interesting. If your mother was exceptionally stressed before and during conception and pregnancy, your stress resilience biologically, epigenetically, will be set lower than someone else, or potentially higher in some circumstances where it's a compensatory thing, right? But it has an effect that is outside of your immediate conscious control, but it's something that you probably can change epigenetically, and certainly with the right supplements, training, mindset, practice, and all that stuff. My experience is that you can take someone who is not resilient and is not able to tolerate stress, and with careful conditioning, programming, changing the environment, you can make someone highly resilient. Have you had that same experience? I mean, you're a psychologist around high performance, different path than I have. Or do you think those people, they're just a delicate flower. They're always going to be a delicate flower. And just how it is.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's some genetic coding like that we need to embrace. And
okay.
I would not suggest that if you were, let's say, you had this incredible mass, you are, let's say 275 pounds and 9% body fat, and a large amount of type 2 fast twitch fibers, I wouldn't suggest, and nor would you suggest that, you know, you invest in running marathons. So this knowing your genetic coding, matching that into an intelligent environment that's going to support and challenge you, and then this relentless, uncommon investment in the internal world is like, there's no secrets, by the way, right? But those are three key elements to finding your very best.
It's true that focusing on your strengths, that's one of the laws that came out in Game Changers, is, if you're built to be a power lifter, don't be a triathlete. You're not going to like your life. And in fact, I had an Olympic medalist and CEO of a DNA testing company on the podcast recently. And it was funny because I was 2% better than the Olympian in terms of the type 2 muscle fibers. So I'm built to like break things and pick them up, but not run very far. So if there's a tiger chasing me, I'm supposed to pick up the triathlete, break them over my knee, and throw them to the tiger so I can get away. It's very clear.
It's very good.
But
good to know that.
I was a little bit better than the athlete. You could kick my ass. But the guy who was the most ripped was the CEO of the company, and he was totally 90% genetically supposed to be an endurance runner, but he had bigger shoulders and biceps than the Olympic athlete or me. And you're like, that's weird, because we do have some control there. What do you do when someone comes in and they're like, I want to be the world's best, and you're like, you're not genetically set up for that, or like, that's going to be way more of a challenge for you than a normal person? What do you say to them?
It's interesting. I don't know, because I don't spend time with them.
I fire them as patients, tell them to get out. Okay, got it.
Yeah, well, I think it's probably useful to give a little bit of a landscape. The way that I organize my life is in working laboratories, and I have one or two clients a month. That's it. Okay. And we spend 8 hours in one day, and it's non-conventional. The traditional model doesn't work for me, which is like this 45-minute, pay as you go. Like, it just doesn't work. So it's an intense, exhausting day to get to insight with a real rich plan to invest in growth. And so I'm fortunate at this point that the people that I'm spending time with are already tip of the arrow performers, and they're saying, hey, listen, I want to grow. I'm already like the gentleman I just spent time with. He announced that he's going on tour, and it sold out in 22 minutes, like across the globe. They're already exceptional at what they do. And so what my experience has been is that most people are looking for peace. Yes. They're looking for contentment. They're looking for a better way of living in the doing that they're doing. And there's a model that I think that we're staring at right now, which has been passed on, I think, by at least two generations, like our grandparents, if you will, our great-grandparents, is that we need to do more to be more.
Yeah.
And I need to do extraordinary to be extraordinary. And I'm watching right now, right in front of my eyes, the best in the world flip that model. And they're saying, no, that's not what it is. I need to be more. I want to be more. And let the doing flow from there. I want to be more grounded, more present, more authentic, more creative, more expressive, and let all of my doing, all of my training, if you will, flow from that orientation. And it's refreshing to hear those conversations from people that you would think are primarily externally driven to be the best. And they're saying, no, I want to be my best. And
yeah,
it's in and of itself, that it's kind of begging the question that you ask, like, what do you say? What I'm hearing is that people want to be their best, not the best, but they're already the best.
Right.
And so
they're committed to the personal improvement, not comparing themselves to others.
Yeah. And I think there's a disavowalment. There's an emptiness when you're chasing the temporary, mm-hmm. and then you achieve the temporary. Like, you're on the podium, national anthems, or you got that $1 million, first millions or whatever. And it's like, okay, is that it? you know, is that, oh God, what am I doing? And there was a game changing moment for me where it was early in my career, about 17 years ago now. And this brilliant little gymnast had the national anthem playing. She was top podium and she was crying, and the whole world thought that she was the icon of achievement. And she, you know, that, oh my gosh, she's really feeling it on the podium. And when she got off, she said, "Did you see I was crying?" I said, "Yeah." And she said, "I'm no different. I thought that this was going to change me, and I'm still miserable."
I love that.
Yeah, there's a dark road. There's a dark path. There's a dark side to performance for sure. Elite performance.
I've had two situations in my life that were like that. The first, I was 22, maybe 23, and I sold the first thing that was ever sold over the internet. It was a t-shirt that said caffeine, my drug of choice. And we didn't have the name e-commerce. No one had ever done it. And I got an Entrepreneur magazine. They're like, "Hey, this fat kid in a double extra large shirt is selling stuff over this inner something or another." No one's ever heard of the internet back then. And, you know, historically, like, oh, that's really cool. But at the time, like, I'm just trying to pay for my college here. I got nothing. So this is, you know, a cool thing. And So I'm like, I'm famous. Like, I've been in Entrepreneur magazine. I'm getting phone calls from reporters all the time. And I was still anxious and miserable and didn't even know I was anxious, but I was not happy at all. I didn't change anything. So like, fame doesn't do it. And I'm like, I don't care about fame. And then 26, I make $6 million. And I told a friend, and this is in Game Changers, both of these, the new book. But I told a friend at the same company where we'd all made more money than we had any business making. Like, I'll be happy when I make 10. Right? Because I was no happier with the money. And so when I look at the results from these, you know, almost 500 people I interviewed in Game Changers, I asked them that question that you've heard on the show, the three most important pieces of advice. Not one person said fame, power, or money. Like it didn't even rate one blip on there. Right? And man, I wish someone had told me that when I was 20, because I was absolutely convinced that those things were going to be the key to happiness. And it sounds like your Olympic athlete was saying, "I'm going to get the gold medal and it's going to make me happy, or it's going to give me peace or give me whatever state I want." And it did nothing.
Yeah. And that's, you know, it almost feels though, saying and talking about it in this way can almost feel elitist in some ways. And I don't ever want that to be the case.
No, it's not meant to be. It's when you've actually done it, it isn't what you think it is, right?
Right. Yeah. And then, but if you haven't done it and you are struggling and you look across the classroom or you look across wherever you are and you see people with nicer shoes, you see people with a nicer car, with a nicer home, a more luxurious, happy looking life, that it at some level, it really is healthy to want better.
Yeah.
And so there's a trap of always wanting better, and something happens in the thin herd of rare space for performers is that if you don't give up the search at some level, you're constantly chasing the next thing, the next, I don't know, the gadget or thing that will help you be better. And there's a healthy part to wanting to be better. And there's also a really important part to say, wait, everything I need is already inside me. And it doesn't feel that way when you look and you're like, but I got broken shoes and my car barely starts and fill in the blanks. And, you know, I've got a leaky roof. So, life is challenging and it's hard. I think life is really hard. And that's why I go back to, like, I don't think there's a shortcut. There's just really embracing this incredible adventure of not knowing.
Well, let's go back to the recording artist who sold out in 22 minutes. Okay, here's a man or a woman who is at the top of their game, clearly making millions of dollars. If you sell a global tour like that, you don't have to worry about money, right? And, you know,
theoretically,
fair point. Theoretically, and all the
more money, more problems.
Well, okay, that's a fair point. Money does bring its share of problems, and there's lots of unhappy rich people because they're afraid of losing it. I'll give you that, but.
Dave, sorry, I know you're rolling here. Yeah. It doesn't have to be that way. I just like it could be that way. That's, you know, I just wanted to say, I don't believe more money, more problems. I believe that, you know, I'd like to hear how you think about money, but I think money is a, incredible amplifier, incredible tool, you know, like.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about money and we'll get back to the recording guy with that question. I've been blessed like you have, I imagine, to spend time with people who have more money than they'll ever know what to do with. Like I helped to sponsor the XPRIZE Visioneering conference this year. This is a room with a couple hundred people with hundreds of millions of dollars each. They're putting, you know, $10 million behind solving the world's next big problem.
How radical.
And it's such an inspiring thing because, you know, the room is full of people who have money and to a T, they'll tell you, I have been blessed with this wealth. Most of them made it themselves. Some of them got it from their parents. But I've got to do something good with it. It creates a moral obligation to do good things. And they're not Scrooge McDuck. They're not Mr. Smithers. And they're absolutely out to say, like, what the heck do I do with all this that's going to have the maximum impact? And those are people for whom the money didn't buy the happiness. It was the impact that they're having with or without the money. And the people have realized that helping other people feels good. So altruism changes your brain, changes your it changes your biology, your neurotransmitters, and it's actually a selfish act because we enjoy helping people. We enjoy knowing that we fed a billion people, or that we sucked the carbon out of the air, or whatever that was the prize that I helped to sponsor. So there's that mindset. But you also can go to like a venture capital conference and you see a bunch of like fearful people who are just, I don't know who to trust. Because I have money and people might want my money and I might lose it and I might have a big tax bill and I don't know what to do. And they can be in a really dark place. And I think they both have equivalent amounts of money. Some are like, oh my God, look at this opportunity. Another one's like, oh, I could lose it. It's clearly psychology that's the difference. Do you agree?
Oh, 1,000%. And like what we're talking about is there's two types of psychology. It's too simple to say that. There's two parts that I'm interested in. There's psychological framework. And then there's the mental skills. So the framework is really the way that you make sense of events, how you understand how you fit in the world and how you're making sense of like how the world is going. So psychological framework is really, it's the heavy stuff. It's the big foundational pillars, you know, to build the house upon. And then the mental skills are the skills and tools to be able to manage stress, to be able to manage an internal way of living that allows you to adjust to the unfolding, unpredictable, unknown. And that, you know, the way that you think about money and the way you think about other people, the psychological framework, I don't know, there's lots of different ways to think about it, but it tends to boil down to, I think you might agree to either threat or opportunity, you know, is a mindset of abundance or a mindset of constriction. And when we get really reductionist, which I'm not a fan of, is like, we could boil down to make it simple, two types of thoughts. Thoughts that create constriction psychologically and physiologically, and then thoughts that create expansion, right? Which is, you know, space, if you will. And at the end of the day, one day, I think we'll be able to observe thoughts. The problem with psychology, or a problem with psychology, is that we can't see it. We can only see the artifact. You know, we can see everything, as you know, from HRV to EEG, like we can see artifact of stuff, but we can't actually see the source. And it's a little bit like gravity. We can't see gravity yet. But we know it exists. We know it has a great impact, but we can't actually see the material of it. One day, maybe, right? Yeah. So how do we get better? At the end of the day, you know, are we measuring artifact or are we trying to increase awareness of our internal mechanisms, right? Like our framework and our skills, basically our self-talk, if you will. So that's the tricky part of the invisible.
There's this Buddhist notion of the hungry ghost, which is one of the realms of hell. And this is one where everyone walks around with distended bellies, and no matter what they eat, they're always hungry. So they can never be satisfied, which is probably a common problem here in the West, not just with food, but with no matter what it is, that they're not satisfied. And I certainly had some of that going on earlier in my life and realized that, you know, that's not where satisfaction comes from, and that changed it. But there are an enormous number of people out there who are dealing with that right now, saying, you know, no matter what I have in my career, my life, you know, I'm not satisfied, therefore I'm not happy. What is your advice? Because I know this happens at the highest level too. The people who, like your Olympic athlete, hungry ghost. I'm gonna eat this gold medal and it's gonna satisfy me. No, I'm still hungry. It's horrible. What's your advice for dealing with that? Whether it's the high level or low level performers?
I really appreciate the question because I'm going to give you an answer that I'll give you an easy answer.
Tell me it's coffee. Come on. You know it's coffee. Okay. Yeah,
right. The easy answer is like, I'm not in the business of advice giving. And so I don't know. Like each person is so complicated and different that what's right for one person is totally opposite for somebody else. It feels that way at least. And then, but then when we get down into it, it's like the best thing I would hope for is to help that person feel that discontent, feel that emptiness, feel the hollowness, feel what that's like. And then they can make a decision about how they're going to organize their life from that point forward. And I don't know. If we could figure out the right research, there's probably like, you need to hear something 7 times and feel it. And then all of a sudden you're like, right. You know, low level hamburger meat gives me a headache. And then for me, maybe I need to hear it 15 times. I need to feel it 15 times. And I go, right. It's the hamburger meat. Or it's the people that I'm around, whatever, fill in the thing. That I think that there's this crazy number, a magical number, where we need to feel it. And some people, like addicts, God love them, have an incredible high threshold for pain. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem, right? Is that sometimes they end up dying, or they need to hit their head on the concrete a few times to say, wait a minute, I gotta change some stuff. Where some people are on the exact opposite side of the spectrum, and I'll use a different analogy. Let's say we're running a marathon, and some people are gonna stop at mile 1 and change their socks because they feel like a blister might be coming on. And some people get to the end of the marathon and they're like, they look down, they're like, oh my God, my feet are bloody. You know, so having that right level of sensitivity, I think, is a really important part of progressive growth, because we gotta deal with some pain. And then we also need to be aware.
I like that. The feeling the pain, actually feeling the pain instead of hiding from it and avoiding the pain. It seems like universal advice. So there you go. The hack is to feel the pain. Do you like that?
Oh my God. Look at you. Look at you. Yeah.
Had to say it. Okay. What's your advice? And I know you're not in the business of giving advice, but I'm putting you on the spot anyway. Okay.
Dave, I think in some kind of way, you and I live in a very similar way and but almost like parallel universes, right? Like, I think that in many ways, we think in the same ways. We're looking for efficiency. We're looking for authenticity. We're looking for, you know, ways to maximize the human expression. And then we have a little bit slightly different attuned vernacular. And so I appreciate you. And so I just want to make sure I'm laughing on the other side going, this is funny.
Oh, likewise. I appreciate you too. And I'm just teasing you about it because I know that we're totally aligned on the questions we're asking. And I'm working on using the language for the biohacking community that, you know, that gets, oh yeah, I think I could do that. Mm. And sometimes there's also the wanting or just the allowing to say, you know what, I wanted to do it faster. Like I didn't have to have the puritanical suffering for multiple lifetimes, or the Buddhist, the slow path to enlightenment is you sort of do nothing. And after you've been through like 10,000 lifetimes or something, maybe you'll get there. And then there's the medium path, which takes a few lifetimes, but at least you're working on it. And then there's the fast path. Like, you can do it in this life, but you might go nuts if you fail. And I'm like, give me that one. Because that's just my personality type. I'm willing to take risks for great rewards. As long as the rewards are worth it and not hungry ghosts. Oh, I'll be happy when I get that. And like, dope. That's not the response you want either. So we were, when I distracted you with my hack comment, we were talking about something else there.
Well, I don't know. Right before this, we were talking about the universal understanding of like feeling pain.
There we go.
And
yeah.
The value of that.
Right?
The
real value of that. I was saying,
But Dave, not getting stuck in the pain.
There you go. That's the flip side of that whole pain conversation. And okay, you're dealing with the highest level performers. And I've certainly seen at least what it looks like in the media. You never know on TMZ or whatever whether it's real or not. But it seems like some of them really are stuck in their pain. I mean, they're wallowing in it. Okay.
Or they're doing everything to avoid it, right?
Which causes
sex, drugs, and rock and roll. You know, that, you know, they're doing everything to avoid it, which causes that cycle of, you know, the not feeling anything, just numbing ourselves.
But in your experience, you know, there is no, there's no one recommendation for, you know, truly feeling the pain and truly dealing with it. My experience with a lot of people, including me, is at a certain point you sort of hit rock bottom. And all right, I don't know how to handle this anymore. I'm going to have to go somewhere else because I really feel like I don't have another choice. There's got to be a better way. Like, I don't want everyone listening to the show to have to, you know, really yeah. Like, oh, I just went to jail, or I was homeless for a while, or, you know, I became an addict and I suffered for years. And eventually I figured out how much it sucked and I got out of it. And like, I've interviewed Joe Polish and, you know, he talks about that real openly. He did all that, but like, I don't want to do that. I don't want anyone else to do that. How do we help them shortcut that?
Okay, so I don't think there's a shortcut, but I think the work, the most efficient work we can do is to line up our thoughts, words, and actions. Okay, and so how do we do that? It's like you've heard the thought or the phrase that the longest distance in the body is from the head to the heart. And so awareness, like investing in the awareness of the internal environment, our thoughts and our words, line those two things up and have the skills to be able to do that in any environment so that the actions have alignment. And the most powerful people are those that have thoughts, words, and actions aligned for their, let's call it mission in life, for their, you know, the purpose and the meaning that they're exploring in what we know to be the material life here. So that's, I don't know. I don't think there's a shortcut to it, but I think that the most efficient investment that we can make in ourselves is increasing the awareness of our internal world. And it is so freaking hard because it's invisible. And for years, we've had a stigma around looking within. Mm-hmm. Now, early days in philosophy, like that's what they did. They looked within and they wrestled with big problems. And then psychology was born out of the medical model. Right. And that medical model looked at dysfunction and what was broken. And I know that makes your hair stand up. That's a crazy way to study something. But there's a great value in that. Right? If you can understand why something broke or how to fix something, it leads us to the conversations we are in now. And I get to stand on the shoulders of incredible giants that have used science to investigate what's good, what works. How do the best thinkers and doers, from a research standpoint, organize their internal life and their external world? And there is that alignment of thoughts, words, and actions that makes it really powerful. So how do you do that? Well, mindfulness certainly is an important part of that process, becoming aware and then having the skills to navigate and adjust, the mental skills, if you will.
Okay. Sounds pretty esoteric and not very nailed down and actionable though. And that's okay. By the way, if you could do that, I think you'd write the next, you know, massive spiritual tome on that, because this is what, you know, every major religious tradition has been working on for thousands of years is that problem. So it seems though that we're reaching the point from what you mentioned earlier around the ability to use heart rate variability and EEG and just to get data about our state, fMRI, SPECT scans, that maybe we can do things differently or faster than we could before, just because we're not just sitting in a cave looking around wondering and feeling and sensing and writing it down and passing it to the next generation, but that it's faster. Is that a safe assumption? I mean, do you see that in your practice with your clients?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you look at how some of the most extraordinary thinkers and doers organize their external world, is they're looking for the most accurate and the most timely feedback. So they have coaches, you know, that are on the field with them, giving them real-time feedback about move your hip this direction, one step back, not a full step back, adjust your elbow. Like, they're getting real-time, mm-hmm. you know, feedback that's highly accurate.
Right.
And so they're craving feedback loops to help them know what to change and how to change it. And so we can use artifact technology, HRV, EEG, fill in mm-hmm. the blanks. We can use that to inform the internal. And so, but that I will say that, and so I invested in an EEG company probably, I don't know, 8 years ago.
Yeah.
And I love it. I think it's a worthwhile investment. The business venture didn't pay dividends for me, but I think that it's an important technology to pay attention to.
Yeah, I have an EEG facility in Seattle. Yeah. You know, but it's work, but it's real science. Like, there's stuff there.
Yeah, we can see some stuff and make some informed thoughts around that. So, yes. And my experience with technology is that it doesn't allow for wisdom.
Yep.
right? It will help with efficiency. And so I'm looking for both, right? So I don't know what replaces internal quiet observation like that and writing. So people often ask, like, what are the most effective ways, you know, outside of technology? And I say, listen to yourself. I say, have great conversations with wise men and women and write, you know, because hopefully you're not BSing yourself and you can't BS a wise person very easily, at least. So those are three mechanisms I think important. And you should see the technology. I love technology. You know, I think it's a really important piece for the feedback loop.
When you say, hopefully you're not BSing yourself, I mean, doesn't psychology as a field exist because people are so good at BSing themselves?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
come on.
We've got narratives and stories. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've used technology to maybe help me get wisdom where, okay, I didn't believe I was BSing myself, but when you look at the EEG, you can see that you're BSing yourself. And it's that mirror that lets you go, you know what? I was believing my own story. Apparently my powers of self-deception are legion. So therefore I should, you know, be less trusting of, you know, the angry voice in my head that, you know, says bad things about myself or other people, et cetera, et cetera. It feels like that is wisdom. I just wouldn't have believed it if, you know, some guru in a white robe told me that. But when I saw the data, I was like, oh man, all right, I'm doing this and I didn't think I was, and I don't want to admit that I was, but I am.
Yeah. And so when I respond to that thought,
yeah,
is that when we are sitting across from a trained psychologist, or we're sitting across an enlightened man or woman, you know, a guru, if you will, or we have a technology across from us, all of those are feedback loops. Now, is technology 100% accurate? Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's noisy.
Yep.
Is the trained psychologist 100% accurate? Sometimes they're great. Sometimes they're not. So, Dave, what I would suggest to you is that you're still looking for an external loop for feedback, whether it's another human, which it sounds like you have low regard for the industry of psychology.
Oh, no, and no, then, not at all. I've done,
which is fine. I'm not mad about it by any means, right?
But if I'm coming across that way, that's a mistake. I routinely tell people you need to go see a therapist or a psychologist or a psychiatrist sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah.
And, you know, all of those are valid fields. And so I was sort of joking. I said, I'm an unlicensed or an untrained psychiatrist. My wife's an ER doctor and she likes to say, I'm a trained physician. And I go, yeah, I'm an untrained physician, 'cause that means I'm not one. Right. So anyway, that was just my internal joke there. But, yeah.
I think there's lots of people that are like psychobabble bullshit. Like, what is it?
I'm not one of those. There's great value in what you do.
Well, but it's the loop that we're looking for.
Yeah.
Right. And so what are those effective loops to help people be more attuned to what? The truth. And like you said, we've got these crazy invisible defense mechanisms that keep us stuck in the same loop until somebody across from us goes, or technology goes, oh, you think you're calm, but actually your heart rate variability is 14. You know, mm-hmm. Like, what do you mean? Like, you know, your normal age population is, let's call it 75. And so, or maybe a licensed or trained professional guru says, so what I hear is, you know, the words, but I don't feel anything. Like, what's that like for you? Mm-hmm. And I go, oh God, yeah, I'm kind of emotionally dead. You know, like, so I think that feedback loops are the end game for growth, and loving the feedback loops, loving the challenge of figuring out iteration is the hard part of wanting to find your very best and be your very best on a regular basis.
It's funny because the feedback loops, whether it's from a intuitive friend, a trained professional, or, you know, your Aura ring,
right,
that they're all useful. And I find that people listen to the show, people are into biohacking, all they're always seeking data. And what's really frustrating in the field of medicine, psychology and all that, is you can have two different doctors or trained professionals who are in the feedback loop, and you get different feedback. So then you have to go through this trusting cycles, right? Which of these professionals is the trustworthy one? And all of them will tell you they're trustworthy, and all of them believe they're trustworthy. And here's the weird thing. They all might actually be trustworthy and still not agree. And you're like, good God, at least when I got my ring, either I had HRV or I didn't. Right.
Yeah, so it kinda, I know there's a freedom with that objective data, isn't there? There's like, and you know, it's, I think it's a little bit like, 'cause we're dealing with the invisible in many ways. Like, what's an elephant look like to a blind person? Mm-hmm. Like, one person grabs a tail, like, oh, it's skinny. One person grabs a trunk, it's like, oh, it's flexible. you know, when someone grabs a belly and they're like, wow, it's really massive. And it's, I don't know the discipline of internal medicine. It feels complicated to me. I don't know the discipline of ER, you know, it's like ER medicine, emergency medicine. It feels complicated. And I think that we're not at a place right now where there's a string theory for human development. Right. We're so far from that. And really, I think when we zoom out and we've got this opportunity maybe to see where we are now and where it's going to be in, let's say, 500 years, it's like, what are we doing? Really, what are we doing? And I it's great. You know, it's just kind of where we are now. And I want to just kind of close the loop on one piece here, which is the most powerful instrument in the world is our brain and our mind, right? The combination of software, hardware, to oversimplify it. It's the most powerful instrument. We don't even know what it's doing. And if we can get more attuned to that feedback loop, holy moly, that feels like that's what we're supposed to be doing.
That's where all the power comes from. And certainly in my own explorations here, Headstrong, my book, how do you turn on more energy in the brain? I noticed that I can put someone through 2.5 times more intense personal development neurofeedback when their mitochondria work, when their brain, the hardware that you talk about is turned on all the way, which allows you to do more with the software. You can do more external stuff or you can do more inner work. But it seems like, you know, if you're eating a diet that's not compatible with your biology, you might not get very far on the personal development, fear, anxiety, you know, becoming a high performer, all that stuff.
Yeah, and if your environment that you're encompassed within doesn't value growth and speaks in ways that are, I don't know, debilitating, negative, hostile in, you know, in the growth arc, and really it can be very sneaky or it can be very obvious, that too plays factor in this accelerated growth.
I think you just covered 4 more laws in the book in that statement. And in Game Changers, you know, there's a couple laws about what your community does to you and how to use it. And certainly one of my favorite laws is about weasel words. You know, the words that you use on yourself or that others use to kind of take away your ability and power. Do you have a set of words you tell the people you coach? Like, don't you be saying that, you know, I can't or things like that. What's your list?
Yeah, I don't have like a list, and I'll tell you why, but I do know I want to help people understand what is right for them, what words work better for them. And so there is a recent research that just came out where, you know, there's at least 2 different types of self-talk, motivational self-talk and instructional self-talk. And we know that instructional self-talk is like walking yourself through the mechanical part of doing something. And that's better for fine motor skill stuff than gross motor. And so motivational self-talk, which is like vibe words to your point, right? Which is like fire, let's go, bring it, can't fade me, whatever kind of that juicy stuff is for a person, that's better for gross motor movements. And eventually we want to turn all of the self-talk off, right? Yeah. We want to get ourselves nodding in a way that like we know that we have what it takes to adjust to the unfolding, unpredictable, unknown, and in some cases, the highest stakes. We just want that nod, that feeling behind our eyes. But self-talk matters, and it can modulate. This is something that is exciting about the research. It can modulate power output. It can modulate experience of heat. And so in hot temperatures, people tend to shut down earlier. It's agitating, right? At distance types events. And so with motivational self-talk, which is that vibe words that you're talking about. Now, I would say you got to know yours. I know mine. And when I say mine out loud, you might say, that sounds cheesy. Okay, you got to know your words. So what are the words that you use that help you bring the right vibe to be you? And that we got to go upstream a little bit. What does it look like and sound like and feel like when you're at your best? And then what are the words that support that? So what back to the research, motivational self-talk is really crisp that it helps people modulate power output, meaning increase it. It helps them with oxygen consumption. It helps them with rate of perceived exertion, and it helps them stay in the heat longer. You know, and I can't remember the exact percentages, but it was a significant difference on those variables, which is pretty cool. Just by what you say to yourself,
that is remarkably cool. All right, tell me about the 6 stages of performance. The way you've dialed this in.
Okay, so at the lowest form of expression is choking. And we've heard that word choking. Okay. Most people don't choke. That's something that is actually relatively rare. And I just want to be almost concrete. It doesn't mean that we're literally choking. It means that we're choking off access to our craft. So our mind creates constriction, both in thought and then in physiological terms, constriction to eloquent movement, eloquent expression, if you will. And that really at the highest form of performance, that's what we're working on. Like mastery is this eloquent, effortless flow of expression, you know? And so choking is at the lowest, then micro choking. It's just kind of this tension. And then there is performing. Then there's performing under pressure. And then there is dissolving pressure. So those are like the phases, if you will. And so there's anything from choking to dissolving pressure. And it substandard is the thought of just thriving or performing under pressure, that there is another layer that we can get to.
Where you don't really feel the pressure, like you kind of took the pressure off and you just do it.
Yeah, you dissolved it. Yeah.
So you're, not to pick on this one client, or we'll say the archetype of the high-performing musician who travels globally. I mean, are most of these people in the dissolving pressure, or like, yeah, I'm going to go on stage, and you know, I'm not feeling the pressure. I'm joyful and I'm here. I know a couple of people like that who are in front of millions and they feel nothing. When like nothing bad when they go out there. There's no, and I know others say every time I've been on stage 10,000 times, every time I'm backstage hyperventilating. What's the ratio of these you see?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that that would be a great research. You know, what is the pre-event experience for, let's say we could get a large sample of like 100 elite performers. That'd be a ridiculously large sample. That's a really good idea that we could possibly do. Maybe we could do it together, but
I'd be up for it.
Yeah, that thought is really cool. And I think I would guess right now, like an a priori, you know, thought about this would be that most are, they vacillate between this tension kind of survival mode. Mm-hmm. And then they get on stage and you'll hear people say often, I just need that first note or that first hit in the ring or that first tackle on the field. And then I settle into it.
And then they're in a flow state after that, and it's a done deal.
Like a low flow, yeah. Right? Like it's good. It's not the most eloquent, but it's like a low flow state.
I think you nailed it. I would guess it's 80 plus percent of those high performers still have a little bit of that. Okay, I feel the pressure. I'm gonna go do it. And then they're somewhere. They just walk out there and they're dialed in and. I think there's some subtle thing the audience feels, but it is rare, right? And the really good ones who perform well under pressure, you probably don't know that the pressure's there because they're good at performing. Like that's part of what performing is. But I think that the amount of energy that they get from it is also different. So it can be a little bit of that adrenaline of like, okay, I've got this now. And then the other one's like, I'm showing up and I'm not going to. Yeah, well, I guess I have a picture with him on my Instagram, so I can say I've chatted with him. I got a chance to talk to Stevie Wonder, and it was an in-depth conversation, which was profound. And you know, he said I just want to, you know, be here to do God's work for you know, as long and as best as I can, sort of thing. And I just get this feeling that when he goes on stage. It's not about him. It's about, you know, doing the work, and it's about service to others. And I just don't think he has that kind of a stage fright thing. I don't get any of that vibe, or not even stage fright, just that pressure, but just more like I'm doing this because of love. And there are people like that out there. And why is Stevie so revered? I think because we feel the love. But that's just, you know.
I'm nodding my head, going that's what a strong psychological framework allows. If you can love people and not be consumed with what they think of you, there's an incredible freedom on the other side of that. Yeah. And most people, when they go on stage, and I remember like this first international moment I had, and it was maybe 17, 20 years ago. And I was backstage and everything was cool and I was feeling it and it was great. And it was my first international presentation. I was like, yeah, this is rad. And I'm there with a buddy, and I was just graduating. So it was about probably 20 years ago now, my program. And the president of the school was there as well. And it was a conference. And so I'm feeling great. And she's giving me this look like, yeah, this is like, look at, like, this is going to be awesome. I can hear the buzz in the background of the room filling up. And my buddy, we're kind of like, look, you know, through the crowd, through the curtain, if you will. And I was going to challenge a theory in the field. Like, who am I to do that? And I didn't quite understand what that meant. And he, my buddy nudges me. He goes, hey, look who's in the front. I said, oh my God, that's him. And I look again and I'm like, now I feel my heart just boom, boom. And wow. Instant sweat. And he looked like he was 8 feet tall, 450 pounds, you know, like this massive human being, much smarter, much bigger, much more dangerous than I ever thought of. Like I was this wet behind the ears kid, if you will. And I just feel entire flight or flight response get on. And you know what happened for me is I just circled and spiraled. What am I doing? I'm going to be exposed. Like, I don't really know. I'm pretending like I know. Oh my God. So it's this full imposter thing that's going on for me. And it was really incredible. And so, I reached into my pocket and cause I thought like, man, I just gotta make sure I have my business cards. God, people are going to blast me. And oh my God. And so I reached and I grabbed my, and I looked down and I don't even have my email address on there. That's how long ago it was. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what a rookie. Like I can't even get my frick. I just printed my cards for the first time. And so, and I look and I said, well, let me at least put my email on the back. And I flip my card over. And I don't know if you, I'm sure you know this, that visual spatial processing is compromised under duress. And right. So, you know, when you do like your name or something and you have to turn it down the side of the page because,
oh, no. Like,
right. Yeah. So it was on my business card and I threw a couple away cause I couldn't get it right. My hands were shaking. And then I locked all of my, this was a game changing moment for me. I locked all of my attention into just having neat penmanship. Mm. And I probably got through about 8 cards, something like that. And I was just engaged in that. And my buddy goes, hey, you're up. And I looked and my heart had changed. My focus was no longer on the threat. It was on something mundane and non-important. And that's when I realized like there's these stages from choking, micro choking, and it happens. It happens so fast. Our brain, our ancient brain in modern times is exceptional. It happened that fast. And that's when I realized like, oh my God, I gotta really invest. Like I need help.
That is so cool. And you know, I think most people who get to where they are, and you see them and you say, oh, like that was easy. They don't talk about what you just talked about. They don't talk about, you know, the 20 years of work that it took to get there. So I think sometimes it creates, like feelings of maybe I'm not good enough from other people. Cause you don't see the struggle. You see the performance and if it was done right, it looked easy, but that doesn't mean that getting there was easy. And so you're talking about that. I think more people have those moments you just talked about than not.
Mm, yeah, hopefully. And I would bet Stevie had plenty of them too, until he finally figured out that, man, love is so much easier.
He must have it. It definitely blew my mind. He's a rare human. All right, I've got one more question for you in the time we have left. Tell me about this compete to create thing you did with Seattle Seahawks coach Pete Carroll. What is it? Why did you decide to do this?
It was going into our first Super Bowl. And so he's extraordinary at the know-how and the structure to switch on a culture where people can explore and find their best. And then my skill set is around helping people that want to be their best invest in the mental part of the game, right? The mental skills part of it. So heading into that first Super Bowl, it was like 1 and 1 equaled something. It's like not 2, but 11.
Right.
And so we're in the hallway at the training center and he goes, can you feel, it was like, I don't know, 3 or 4 games left in the season. He goes, Mike, can you feel this? And I was like, yeah, it is rad. It was like unbelievable to be in the building. Like people are just bouncing around, flying around, feeling really strong and sturdy, both physically and emotionally. And he goes, do you think anyone outside of sport would be interested in what we're doing? Now he's got 60-year history of being like masterful. And my eyes kind of got big and I didn't know what to say. And he goes, let's just write it down. And I go, yeah. And so we kind of ready, break. And you know, the next day I had on the back of a napkin all the things that I have been doing, you know, with him, and separately that I thought were important. He did the same. We put it together. We had this, call it a curriculum, if you will, mm-hmm. like the things that we had been doing. We're just trying to artifact or archive what we did. And, you know, so he calls and calls Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft.
Yeah.
And he says, hey, congratulations. It was 4 weeks into the job. And he says, just wanted to meet you and say hi and whatever. And I had done a little bit of work at Microsoft with a small sales group. And so Satya is informed on some of the stuff we're doing through Pete. And he says, I'd love to introduce you to Mike and give you a sense of what we're doing, and both in your company, but really what we've done as a body of work. And so that turned into just this beautiful relationship with Microsoft, 180,000 employees.
Wow.
And Satya Nadella saying in this meeting, he's got this beautiful office overlooking, you know, Seattle proper. And he says, you know, what I want to create is a meaningful place for the 180,000 people while they're here with us at Microsoft. And we have bold ambitions to do amazing things in the world. And, you know, basically we want to empower every person or organization in the world to do more, to achieve more. And it was the beginnings of his mission and the beginnings of something that was coming from a very deep, rich place for
him. Wow.
And so we got an opportunity, and the opportunity was to work with a group of 12, and that turned into a group of, you know, 200, and that turned into a group over time of 30,000 people at Microsoft. And we worked with 30,000 people at 8 hours a person. And that was 240,000 human hours of mindset training to helping people find and become their very best. And we said, oh my God, we can't meet the demand. So we built on the back of a learning management system, an 8-week online course. And so that is the beginning story arc, exciting, wonderful opportunity that we've got on this company called Compete to create. And Compete is Pete's central word for his philosophy. And competing is like not trying to be better than somebody, but working and striving to become your very best. And then the central word of my philosophy is to create a living masterpiece. And so, you know, the creating is the expression of a living masterpiece. So compete, strive and strain to become your best so you can create a living masterpiece. And that's the origins of our company. And it's basically, we've got two products, an 8-week online course and an 8-hour in-day experience that we've hired Olympians and sports psychologists to deliver. And what we think is an incredible investment of 8 hours in the interior.
Very, very cool. And it's an elegant name when you understand how it all links together. It's been a pleasure and an honor to have you on Bulletproof Radio today. And because I just wrote Game Changers and I've asked hundreds and hundreds of people those three questions, I'm not going to ask them for you because I'm working on this other thing. I was in men's health along with Peter Thiel and a couple other people. I am actually planning to live to at least 180 years old. So question for you, how long are you going to live and how long do you want to live?
It's cool. I've thought about it. I want to live in a way that has purpose and meaning and is like helping this planet to thrive. And so the duration, shit, I don't know. I mean, if you think about Jesus, he lived 33 years old and changed the frickin' globe. Buddha didn't live that long, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I mean, James Dean changed music, you know? Yeah. Like, so I don't know. I wish I was as potent as some of those names that I just mentioned. I'm not sure James Dean and the Buddha were as potent, but you know what I mean? Like, I wish I was
that
potent. You
got a wide variance there.
Yeah, so I don't know. And I love that you've got this target number of 180. Have you talked to Tom Ballou?
I have, yeah.
Yeah. So I had a conversation with him on the Finding Mastery podcast, and he's got, you guys would vibe, I think, because he's got that same desire and want. I don't have a good answer for you there.
It's all right. I mean, it's partly about, a lot of people haven't thought about it. And so if you have a goal for how you want to perform, how much money you want to have and all this stuff, but you haven't thought about what I want it to look like when I'm old. And I tell you, when I'm 180, I want to be highly functioning. I'm walking around in my own power, feeling good, looking good, and still actively giving back. And that's a very different picture of being, quote, old. Because most people, they think of it and immediately they go to diapers, walkers and putting your car keys in the fridge. And that's their picture. And like, right. No way, man, I'm not going out like that. Yeah. And no one has to. And so I'm asking because when you get a chance to talk to someone like you, you've done a lot of introspection. You've talked to a lot of interesting people. Like, how much have you thought about it? Like, are you planning for it? So it's always informative. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, no, thanks for the question. I'm gonna wrestle with that a bit. Awesome. For sure. And Dave, before we jump, I just want to say thank you. Thank you for having me on. I think, there's challenges in our conversation that I loved. I love the sparring. Oh, yeah. I love the joking. I love the intensity. I really love that we can have that conversation because, I know you've got a learned mind and a disciplined approach to growth. And so I'm stoked to have the conversation with you. I just want to say thank you.
You got it, man. And, yeah. And likewise, hopefully you don't mind me giving you a hard time about stuff because it's all in good fun and learning.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, Michael Gervais, your home website, I would say, was findingmastery.net. Is that sort of the best place for people to go?
Yeah, that is.
You want to learn more?
Yeah, that's like a funnel, if you will, of this capture of extraordinary thinkers and doers. And it's the podcast that we fired up to celebrate people.
But that URL, findingmastery.net, that has your podcast, it also has links to Create to Compete on it?
Yeah, Compete to Create.
Oh, sorry. There you go. I said it backwards. So Compete to Create. So basically, if you're interested in the type of coursework and coaching that Michael has done for some of the world's very biggest names, you can find it there. And you can also hear about his podcast, Finding Mastery, on that same URL, findingmastery.net. Michael, thanks again, man.
Appreciate you.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.